crazy cool student art. Registration is February 25th. That's when you drop off the artwork. And you drop it off at Reynolds High School.
And Renee, do you have any, do you want to give us ways to find you and more information about your work online for listeners of the podcast?
Yeah, people can go to embodiedastrology.com, E-M-B-O-D-I-E-D, astrology. And I put out free horoscopes every month, and they are available on iTunes and Spotify and Stitcher and all the other podcast apps.
Great, thanks.
Thanks for inviting me to be here.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming.
Welcome to Art Talk Bus Stop, a monthly interview series with Portland area artists about how they do their work and make a living. I'm Nicole, a freshman at PCC.
And I'm Erica Thomas, producer of the show. We are co-hosting remotely, and we're excited to welcome our guest, Jody Darby. Jody is a media artist, activist, and educator, specializing in experimental video and photography. Her projects deal with rebellion and joy, and her work seeks to amplify stories that often go unheard while pushing back at the narratives of dominant culture. Jody, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for inviting me.
We had talked early on, Nicole and I, about just asking you to describe your work in your own words. How do you describe your work to young artists or non-artists?
Well, you know, it's taken me a minute to get to a place where I can actually talk about my work, because I feel like I am constantly experimenting and constantly sort of trying new things and dropping them and picking them up again. And I think that the thing that I've kind of landed on and stuck with for the longest amount of time is kind of reappropriating moving images. I love taking still photos. I love photography. In terms of using a film camera or a digital camera to tell stories, it's not my thing. I'm not really excited about like creating a storyboard and shooting all these scenes over and over again. Or it's just, I've learned that the thing that really excites me is taking stuff that people have already shot, right? Taking, you know, old films, taking people's home movies and taking them apart and adding things together that don't belong there, or changing a narrative from a story, like completely changing the end by editing some different things in there, changing history, making history turn out the way I want it to turn out instead of the way it actually turned out. You know, I mean, it's kind of a little bit of playing God, but you know, it's fun. My work is definitely using moving images, reappropriating them, changing them through an editing process, and doing that from a place, I think, of intuition. Mostly when I sit down in front of a computer to edit, I don't know what I'm going to do until I start doing it most of the time. Unless it's like a commission work and someone says, you got to do it this way, I kind of just sit there and like, I kind of like trance out. I kind of just like let it kind of overtake me for editing. I mean, people think editing is such a like boring, linear, nerdy thing. And it is sometimes, but it can also be like a opportunity to like channel some heavy stuff too.
Yeah, there's definitely like a rhythmic thing with editing. The trance thing is something that's relatable to me as a former editor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, also like your whole body goes numb because you're not moving it, which is weird, you know, which is not ideal. But especially working with home movies as raw material, like it's like going through people's underwear drawers. Like it's, you know, like you really get your hands on some stuff.
Well, you mentioned sort of taking stuff that isn't necessarily personal to you and recreating it in a way that you want to. How do you go about doing that? And how did you first, what first drew you to doing that?
I mean, I've always loved film, and I've always loved the way film looks. Just like the process of celluloid against light. Like, just blows my mind every time, you know? I can't get enough of it. I realize that I don't get that feeling when I look at video. Like, I like stuff. I mean, there's definitely people who shoot video that make it beautiful, and it's nice to look at, especially on a big screen. But in terms of just like, there's like a feeling that I get when I see film, and I wanted to like live in that world. I wanted to like sit in that world and like have that feeling all the time. So I started playing around with this archive that a guy named Rick Prelinger, he created a thing called the Prelinger Archive, where there are all these, basically anything you would want to look at movie image wise on film is in this archive. And he uploaded them so that people could borrow them, take them and use them for things. So it's royalty free moving image archive. And there's all kinds of stuff on there. And I spent a lot of time looking, beginning to like look through the archive just to kind of be like, who are we? What is the material of our existence? What are the things that people felt like they needed to capture? Like, what were the things that are the most, is it like your kid's birthday party? Or is it like what are, and then how do different people handle their Super 8 cameras in the 50s? Like, just, there's just a million questions that watching those things kind of like answer and turn me on. So then I started kind of, after looking at those, I started playing around with them. I think, you know, probably the first piece that I did using borrowed footage wasn't even about like anything emotional. It was me trying to figure out how to edit action, because I recognized that all the work that I had done in terms of editing was like documentary with like a head talking at you, and then it would cut to like some other thing, and there was like never any action that I was trying to edit. And I wanted to get good at editing something a little more dynamic visually. And so I just downloaded a whole bunch of like clips of dude movies, you know, like these action movies of like men running and jumping and shooting each other and beating each other up, just to see how I could put them together. And I made a movie called Man Movie, sort of playing around with this idea of like the dramaturgy of action movies and the things that men do with their body over and over again in these movies. And so I edited all those together, and I was like, man, this is fun. I'm going to do this all the time now. So I'd be like, oh, I want a scene of somebody getting a chair over their head in a bar, right? And so then I would be like, okay, Roadhouse. Somebody gets hit with a chair in Roadhouse. I remember that. And I would just think about all the movies where somebody got a chair to the head, and then I would try to find that scene and put them all together. So you just be like, ching, ching, over and over and over and over. And it's, you know, I enjoy that sort of thing, I guess. Mm-hmm.
Just to kind of like get a timeline of when this was in your life, was this before or after college, or was this like in your adolescence, or?
No, this is now, man.
Oh, wow.
That's funny. No, I didn't do, I mean, when I was an adolescent, there was like no such thing as any of this, right? Like, there weren't computers. I went to college for film. I mean, I went to college for media studies, which looks very different than your experience with media studies, right? Like, I did probably a lot of the same things that you do, but instead of Photoshop for graphic design, we would do what's called paste up. And we would do it all on paper, and we would have what were called rapidograph pens that we would draw with. We had Lectraset letters, which were these like sheets of, you would get, go like to the art supply store, and there'd be one of those like swivel things, like, you know, greeting cards were on or whatever. And it would be like Helvetica. And you would like buy a pack of Helvetica Lectraset letters, and you would rub them off with a quarter to transfer the letters onto your design, right? And then if you wanted a picture, you would take the picture with your camera with the film in it, and then you would take it to the dark room and you would develop it. You know, I mean, it was just like tactile, and it was like these like processes, arduous processes. So then after I graduated from college, like 1992, then everything went digital. which was wild. And then I became an instant dinosaur because I didn't know how to do any of that stuff. And so I spent years denying that this digital thing would even catch on. Like, I was so upset with all the, like, craft that I had learned, right? Like, everything that I learned to do, and I love doing it. I love physically being in the dark room and smelling those chemicals that were rotting my brain out. And, like, I loved using my hands, right? I loved doing that process. And then I was just like, you cannot tell me that if I want to do this work for the rest of my life, I have to stare at a screen. Like, that is not my karma. That is not my reality. I'm not going to do it. And so I, like, waited tables and I bartended and I did all kinds of stuff for years before I learned how to do digital work. I mean, years. I was a grown up. I was in my like late 20s before I like started figuring out how to like do digital art again.
Did you end up ever like actually taking any classes, or did you just become self-taught?
I went to PNCA. This was back in the Pleistocene. When was it? Let's see. I moved to Portland in 1996. I think I took the class maybe 1998 at PNCA, and it was a Photoshop class, and I hated it. I hated every second of it, and I was awful at it. Like, I was just like, what is this? The only thing that I liked about it was that the processes in Photoshop were named after the processes in actual graphic design that I was, you know, there's like the burn tool, the dodge tool, you know, like there were things that I could like truck with because I'd done it in the dark room. And I was like, oh, that's cool. They're actually like borrowing the language and they're using the language of the actual, you know, what I considered like the right way of doing it. I didn't take any other classes after that. And I just taught myself. Like, I just sat down and figured it out.
Nicole, you were curious about, Jody mentioned moving to Portland in, what'd you say, 1996?
I think so.
Ish.
Well, I think the people should know. You grew up on the East Coast, correct?
Correct. Yeah, right outside of Washington, D.C.
So when you made that move to Portland, what drew you to coming over here? Because I know from, like, looking at some of your work, you've been kind of all over the U.S. and a little bit of out of the country. So what made you kind of get up and station yourself here?
I wanted to get as far away from my family as I possibly could. I actually, when I graduated from college, I went to college in Virginia, and the day after I graduated, I got in my car with my friend Kelly Cobb, and we drove cross country, and she left me in San Francisco, and I lived in San Francisco for a minute. It wasn't my thing, but while I was there, I took a couple trips to Portland, and I loved it. There was something about, I was like, this place is disgusting. I love it. Like, it was like, it was like run down and like gritty. And it's funny because I realized after I moved here that it wasn't really as run down and gritty as I thought it was. It was just my friends that I was hanging out with took me to all the like rundown, gritty places. They gave me the tour of like all the like grossest bars in Portland and the shadiest places. But I liked it, and I had friends here already, and they were going to the Northwest Film Center, and they were in bands, and they were making movies, and it just seemed like a great place to connect and be an artist.
I see. So, kind of focusing on Portland, one of your works from 5 years ago now is called Arresting Power, Resisting Police Violence in Portland, Oregon. So, I'm going to be really honest with you. I thought you were really quick to make this, and I thought you made it around with, like, everything going on in 2020. But then I went to go watch it, and it was made in 2015. And at that time, I was maybe 12, 13, so I didn't know much about what was happening in the world. And I know this project, as Erica was telling me, it took some time for you to make. When did you start the whole, like, process of this, and when did you start filming everything, getting the interviews?
Yeah, well, thank you. That's a compliment. We worked on that film for 5 years. It started out, Julie Perini had moved to Portland and had lived here for a couple years and was involved in activism. She reached out to myself and Aaron Yankee to collaborate on something. We weren't really sure what, but she wanted to do something that was about policing in Portland. This was also around the time that, like, Portlandia was just taking off, and so we kind of wanted to talk about how, like, Portland is not like that. She reached out to us because we had a show together, Aaron and I, on KBOO, called Circle A Radio, for about 10 years. And it was an anarcha-feminist public affairs show. And Julie knew that we knew a lot of people who were involved in activism. Like, we knew their phone numbers. And so she was like, hey, can we work together? And so out of that collaboration came the first iteration of Arresting Power, which was called Safe and Sound. And it was an installation. And it was basically talking to folks who had negative experiences with police, whether it was they had family members who were killed by cops, or they themselves had had experiences with police here in Portland. And the installation was at Place Gallery. There used to be a gallery upstairs in Pioneer Place Mall, which is wild. A guy, Gabe Flores, used to run that. A lot of people came to that, and a lot of people were interested in it. And we recognized that there was a desire to learn more. Like, people were like, you know, what? This is all news to me. So then we decided we were going to do something larger, and we wanted to include stories of resistance as well, because that's an important part of the story. And so that is the point at which we started, doing more research, doing more interviews, finding people to talk to, sort of deciding if we were going to just, talk about, like, folks of color, people with mental health issues, like, how we were going to frame it. And so that was, I would say, I couldn't even tell you, a few years. It took us between 4 and 5 years to finish. So it started out as a very different project.
What specifically was your role in this film?
It was a collective effort, which is like, this is not the way movies get made, right? Like, but we decided that we wanted to make a movie where we all shared skills and we all took turns doing all of the things. So, for example, my role was cinematographer. Like, I ran the cameras. It was interviewer. It was researcher. I edited. I did titling. We went and got, music supervision. And we all did those things. And we taught each other, which was wild, because I don't think I'll ever do that again. But it was an incredible experience, right? And it was like, we were a three-headed entity, we weren't a monster. I was going to say we were a three-headed monster. We weren't monsters. But we had three heads. Like, I feel like I didn't, go to the bathroom during that five-year period without calling Aaron and Julie and being like, hey, I think I'm going to go to the bathroom now. Like, everything we did, we, ran by each other. Like, as far as the movie, everything that we did. So if I was editing, I would edit for a day, and then I would send that cut to them, and they would give me feedback, and then I would go make the changes. It was just constant feedback. Or we were just in the same room together all the time working on it. There was, no separation of roles. And I don't know of any movie that's happened that way, you know, like a feature-length film. I don't know. Maybe that's a research project.
Yeah. I feel like I can sort of relate to, like, the how things aren't normally made like that, but I feel like anything that I do is sort of like that. It's normally not made like that, and I just make it way more harder on myself than it should be. But sort of going off of that, I believe it was you, or it could have been either you, Julie, or Aaron. In an interview, you guys talked about how it was a lot more than you guys realized it was going to be. As if you'd gone on a date with someone who you had a crush on, and you ended up pregnant at the end of it. So going from there, if you could go back to the film and do anything differently, even if it was just one thing or maybe the entire thing, how would you go about remaking the film?
Oh, wow. That's a great question. Nobody's ever asked that question before. I don't know if it's the best answer, but we had a thing happen where we decided we wanted to use this archival footage that we got from the Oregon Historical Society. They have a moving image archive. It's like out in the east side. And we went there to look to see what they had in terms of like civil rights marches and like, well, all the stuff that's now in the movie. And we saw it and we were like, oh my God, we have to have all of this. I mean, this is gonna make the movie poignant and feel, you know, real. And then we learned that that stuff cost $12 a second. I know, I made that same face, Erica. And so we're like, well, we can't do that. I mean, we didn't have any money, right? And so, but we saw it. We couldn't unsee it. We had to have it, right? And so we got underwritten by KBOO. So we got the nonprofit deal of $6 a second. And we did a Kickstarter. Then kind of soon after we did that and the film was made, Matt Cowan, who runs the Moving Image Archive for the Oregon Historical Society, told us that they decided that footage, all the footage there should be free. And so now it was. Doing that Kickstarter was so panic-inducing. I will never do another Kickstarter again. I feel like it took years off of all of our lives. And I think if I could do something different, I would have talked Matt Cowan into giving us that footage for free and not doing a Kickstarter.
Sort of going onto the topic of like grants and residencies, can you kind of talk about the process of receiving either a grant or a residency?
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible as somebody who's like making things and putting them out in the world to receive something like that. It's like, it's not just like, oh, wow, I can do this project because I have the funding for it, but it's also like, oh, you see me, or you see the worth or the value in this project. And it really does mean a lot. Because sometimes it can feel like you're making stuff in a vacuum and like nobody cares but you. So, you know, I feel like, you know, getting accepted to a residency or getting, you know, having a grant accepted it's not just about the thing itself. It's about like feeling recognized and appreciated.
As of right now, it's kind of hard to create things and be collaborative. How do you think you're either going to work on your own things during this time or sort of afterwards, the aftermath of this pandemic? How do you think your work would translate to?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. I just did a big project with my partner, who is a flower farmer. And a ceramicist. She works in porcelain. And we collaborated on a project that was called Portal. And it's one project in a larger kind of constellation of things that we're going to do together. We intend to like keep collaborating and keep doing work. And it's the work that we did and that we want to continue doing is landscape-based. So it's site-specific installation work in a landscape outside. And so we were able to do that because, I mean, we lived together, so we could hang out. And then, you know, she's working outside in these plots planting. And then people came and they came to the closing. The work that we did was, it's not up on my website yet because it just happened, but I created videos that were memorials for people who were killed by police, and we put them in the locations of the murders. And originally what we wanted to do was create kind of like goggles, kind of like, you know what a ViewMaster is? Usually they're red and they're these little like plastic toys that you like put a circular little cartridge in, and then you can like do this and the cartridge moves and you see different images going around. We wanted to make those. We wanted to make goggles. Mariana was going to make them out of porcelain and then put them around the city. And there would be, she would build a slot in the back so that you could slide your cell phone in. And so there would be, you'd go to this place, there would be these goggles, there'd be a QR code, right? You click on the QR code and the video starts. You put it in the goggles and you look in, and it transports you to this portal of remembering the person whose life was taken in this spot. That was the original idea. And then COVID came and we were like, people aren't gonna wanna put their faces on stuff. So we had to change that. So we still made the videos. There were still memorials. There was a huge plot of marigolds that she was tending throughout this whole process that she was growing on a site in Kenton, in the Kenton neighborhood. And those flowers were kind of the mother site for all of the different memorials. We would harvest those marigolds and take them to the different sites all over the city. So that just happened. And then I just finished making a video for this guy, Chris Funk. He's a local musician. He's in a band called The Decemberists. He also does solo stuff, and he just put out a new record, and he asked me if I would do a music video for him. So I did. And it's going to, I don't know, be released sometime soon. I don't know when at all. But so I'm still kind of chucking along with stuff. I think I would get really depressed if I wasn't doing something, right? But yes, I much prefer working with other people. I don't know, it's like expansive. There's an expansiveness to it that you're like, you're not just making art and then that's it. Like you're forming relationships that are long lasting, or, you know, ideally.
I have one last question. We all like to ask all of our guests, do you have any advice for emerging, aspiring artists or creative people?
Don't listen to them. Just do what you want to do. Listen to yourself. Experiment. Try a lot of different things on. And don't try to be perfect. It's funny because if we had a friend that always told us, like, oh, you're awful, that's terrible, like, we wouldn't hang out with them, right? So, like, why would we do that to ourselves? Don't do that. Just believe in yourself and just keep playing around.
Excellent advice. I think that's a kind of a common theme too. A lot of people are like, just keep making stuff. It's not going to be great until it is. Just keep making it.
Yeah. Yeah. And then one day you'll wake up and it'll be like the coolest thing ever.
Cool. Thanks for being here with us, Jodi. It was really great. I've been wanting to invite you on the show since we started. So I'm super glad
you.
We got a chance to talk with you.
Yeah. It's really nice to have you on here.
Thank you so much. And best of luck to you.
This has been a rebroadcast of two archival episodes of Art Talk Bus Stop. Our show airs the fourth Wednesday of every month. Tune in May 25th for a brand new episode.
90.7 FM.
Tune in Thursdays from 6 to 7 p.m. to hear Rose City Native Radio with your host, Jackie Malmstrom. Rose City Native Radio is a new public affairs program bringing you local and national Native issues and Native contemporary music. You can find more information about the show online at kboo.fm or find us on Facebook at Rose City Native Radio.
Good afternoon, lovers of jazz. Welcome to a new edition of Jazz Lives, coming to you locally at 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm. I am Marcia Hawker, your host until 2 o'clock, and we are continuing with our special program for Jazz Appreciation Month. In my first hour, Dan Davey, director